This podcast with Randall Peterson is a London Business School lecture on creating the teams of the future. Randall Peterson is a professor of organisational behaviour at London Business School, and much of his research focuses on leadership in organisational work teams, personality and leadership success, and top management team decision making.
All right. Thank you. Pleasure to be here. So I'm going to talk specifically about issues of collaboration. Our ability to collaborate has never been more important, and going into the future, you know, is more important, combined with kind of disappearance of a lot of our hierarchical structures, makes for a very confusing time for how to collaborate, and yet we've got to get it right. So that's really the theme, what I'm going to talk about today. So I'll talk about why teams collaboration, why is it so important. I'll talk a little bit about what I mean by high-performance team. I'll then talk about the mistakes that get made. There are three or four kind of key mistakes that are typically made here, and then what research, evidence-based research, says about how to address some of those challenges. So that's the agenda for the next hour. As Gary said, if you want to ask a question, do feel free as we go, or I'll leave some time at the end to make sure we got a time to discuss as well. It's obvious, but I start here, which is, it's not a new idea, the importance of collaboration. It's really the essence of, you know, of our success. It really is, you know, together, in things we can achieve individually versus what we can achieve together are not even linear. It's actually an accelerating curve. That's why collaboration is so important. And if you think about it, of course, we start life in a team or in a group, if you want to just call it a group. We operate our entire lives in groups, whether it starts in the family, how we work, how politics works, how pretty much everything works is in team, kind of embedded in everything that we do. But why is it a challenge right now? Well, because if you think about the way we're looking at teams right now, first, we're asking teams to operate in a really complicated environment. We were talking just before we started here about the old version of matrix organization, where you've got the functions and the projects going in different directions. I mean, today that looks kind of simple compared to a person maybe on four or five different teams interacting with a variety of types of things. Maybe their role in each team is not even the same. In this environment where the teams are meant to work together, but they don't always work together. And so it's a complex environment we ask them to operate in. And then we pick a group of experts and we ask them to coordinate here. So I've got here a couple of examples. If you're of a certain age, you'll remember the A team, right? If you think about that team, that is actually a metaphor, really, for the kinds of teams that we work in today. Each of the four men had a very particular role that they did regularly. But the more complicated we've got now is, say, the surgical team. When you have surgery, there's a very good chance that the team operating on you has not worked together before. Every time you fly a plane, that team has probably not worked together before. Each has a particular role. They come together, and we expect them to function to keep, for them to perform major surgery or to keep us in the air and safe. That's a big ask. If you really step back and think about it, it's really remarkable. And that's the way of the future, the need to coordinate, despite the fact that perhaps we've not even worked together before. And the problems we're dealing with are complicated. If you think about everything from globalization to digitization, it's a difficult world out there, and we are asking teams to do all of it. I think this is probably the best statement of it from one of my former students, Heidi Gardner, who's at Harvard now. Most firms carve up their highly specialized professional services into these functional roles and then expect them to work together and collaborate. And that is the, you know, what most firms are doing to create these integrated or to address these complicated integrated problems. Now, it's not just Heidi or me saying this. Over the last about 6-7 months, here's a small list of firms that have talked to me about collaboration. How do we improve collaboration? How do we take what we're doing and take it to the next level, take it to the next step? If you're interested in the topic, there are a wealth of resources out there. Here's just a small list. If you go into Amazon, those are the best sellers on teams and collaboration. And there's a range in there about what they're about and about how to do it. I've talked about the one. You probably will know a couple of the others. But it ranges from leading teams, great performances, which is a very research-based one, to Heidi's, which is research-based, but very focused on the professional services, to small groups with purpose. How to get teams of people in your religious setting to work together. So everybody's interested in the topic and wanting to do better. Google's gotten in on the act. They had a lot of publicity for their work on what creates great collaboration and teamwork in Google over the last few years as well. What do I mean by collaboration? Let's make sure we're clear on this. First, it's the act of working together to produce something that's very simple. The key here really is that it's about bringing together diversity within the organization, the knowledge diversity, the other types of diversity, to create value for your business. That's really what it's about, okay, at its core. There are some things I want to make clear it's not. So what I'm talking about is not kumbaya, we're all going to give each other a big group hug, right, and just feel good, right? It has to be about creating value for the business. It is not more meetings. The millennials I work with, they're coming into the MBA now, complain in a way that's hard to explain about, oh my God, if I have to go through another meeting, you know, they're just sick of constant meetings. How do I collaborate without just more boring meetings? So I don't mean more meetings per se. I also don't mean we, the minions, make you, the stars, look like stars. There's a lot of what passes for collaboration that kind of fits that bucket. That's not really what we're talking about. Real collaboration is we come together as equals. We're all bringing something to the table. And it is not, would you like fries with your burger? Cross-selling. Okay, as long as we're in here anyway, can I sell this or sell that? It's not really collaboration. Collaboration, again, is coming together to really create something that none of us could create individually. Now, before I jump in and start talking about some of the issues and problems, I'm going to actually give you a little quiz, see what you think. There are six things here about working together in a diverse team, actions you can take as a leader. And I'm going to ask you to vote for one or two. Which ones do you think are most important here? So first one, ensure that all team members feel psychological safety, feel that they can say what they need to say. Two, focus on creating cooperation. Make sure that people are focused on what's good for the group. Third, ensure that the team operates in a well-coordinated fashion with few misunderstandings. They're not starting and stopping, reversing, and having to do it again. Four, provide clear process and direction with the team. Five, emphasize shared values within the team. And six, draw attention to the diversity of perspectives around the table. Let's do this. I'm going to ask for some hands. How many of you would vote for the first one, psychological safety? Hands up. Good number of votes. Okay, good. A high degree of cooperation. How many of you vote for that one? Few less, okay. Third, make sure the teams operate in a well-coordinated fashion. Three, four, five, okay, so a few there. Four, provide clear direction, process. That's usually a big vote getter. Good, okay, it is here. Emphasize shared values and culture. Reasonable vote count, good. Draw attention to diversity within the room. Okay, handful, all right. I'm going to share with you, we asked this question on the school's leadership survey, thousands of practicing managers out there, what they think on this topic. And here is the answer. So they focused or endorsed three things. First, provide clear direction and process to the team. That was the biggest vote getter for them. Second biggest vote getter was shared values and culture within the team, emphasizing shared values and culture. And third, focusing on creating a high degree of cooperation. What I want you to notice about these three in particular is that they're rather top-down. Most leaders think that the best way to ensure cooperation is for the leader to take a very assertive, kind of aggressive posture and really make sure top-down that we understand the values and everybody's working for the team. We do far less of the more kind of facilitating an environment or culture here. And I'm going to draw attention to those because you guys got that first one really well. The sense of psychological safety, that I can say what's on my mind. This is critically important for teamwork. You guys got that one. Far fewer votes for coordination, making sure that we don't misunderstand each other. Turns out I've got two check marks there because it's typically missed, and it's actually probably the single most important thing you can do in this complicated environment with teams is to make sure not that everybody's working for the good of the group. Turns out when you really get into the research, most people go into a team and diverse team thinking, this is interesting, I might learn, I want to do this. What happens is we get partway in and you said something, I'm really not getting where that's coming from, or where there's a misunderstanding of some type, or I issue a request to you, you go off and do something completely different. Now, whose fault is that? Is that your fault for not understanding, my fault for not being clear, right? Or there's probably some between us. I mean, the real issue is it's a group level or a dyadic phenomenon, not a me versus you. Groups love to blame. So what happens is we have a misunderstanding and then we blame the person who's different. So it's not that we go into the room saying, I don't want to work with that person who looks different from me. We go into the room thinking, this could be interesting. And then we find it really hard. And then there's a big misunderstanding. So who do you blame? The person who's different. It's at the core of all of the stuff that will unravel teams very quickly and collaboration. So it's the one most missed issue in encouraging better collaboration in this environment. And then the last one, drawing attention to the diversity within the room, its function serves three. Its function is, look, everybody, we have different points of view around the room and different types of people. So probably you should expect some misunderstanding. It turns out if you expect it, it doesn't swamp you. It's when you don't expect it and then you see it and you're like, oh man, how do you... In fact, the hardest type of diversity for organizations to deal with is actually functional diversity most of the time. I'm from one function, you're from another, but we're all in the same company. And chances are, you know, I may even look like you, may even sound like you. And then you say something that's completely different from the way I'm thinking about it. It surprises me. And now my mind goes directly to, you know, negative attributions about the individual. So this is what you're trying to resolve as you're doing this. I'll talk a little bit more about this kind of as we go, but I really want to draw attention to coordination issues in these teams. So if you want a high performance team, here's the three criteria that you should be looking for. First one's really obvious. You know, they need to produce good stuff. So that's why it's not kumbaya, we all love each other. You have to be producing stuff that is good for the business and good for the organization. Second, do individual members feel like they benefit from the team? If you want people to engage in the team and collaborate with you, you have to think about what's in it for them. If you don't think about what's in it for them, not surprisingly, they're not going to give you their best. And then third, are the dynamics within that group viable over time? Meaning you're not just surviving till you get to the next deliverable. If you ever find yourself in that boat where it's just survive till you get this big project done, this is a big red warning sign on the dashboard saying be very careful. Because then once you reach that point, you should expect turnover and you should expect people to disengage. Probably not a good idea. Or here's another way to think about it. If that doesn't resonate, here's another way. You got to have the right people around the table. And when I say right people, I mean perspectives, skill sets. I do not mean a collection of stars. Let me repeat that. Don't go about creating a group or a team of people that's focused on having the five biggest brains in the room. Now, having the five biggest brains in the room, and I'll say it's not bad, but again, unless you have all the skill sets you need, you're probably not going to be successful, number one. Number two, stars like to be stars. Not surprisingly, they don't like to collaborate. So I had the great pleasure here about a year and a half ago of having Sir Alex Ferguson come and talk about his experience at Man United. And somebody in the audience asked what was a really great question. So you didn't have a lot of stars, and yet you were incredibly successful. And the stars you did have, you tended to trade off. Like, you know, they reach star quality and then they leave. Why? his answer I thought was like amazing, perfect. He's like, you know, here's the problem. When people become a star and it starts to be all about them, they start treating everybody else as lesser human beings. At first in little ways, over time in bigger ways. And you may be the best striker in the world, but if nobody passes you the ball, you're not going to be very successful. So what I'm doing is it's totally okay for them to reach a degree of notoriety, but as soon as I see any signal of their unwillingness to truly collaborate as equals with other people, even people of lesser skill, now they've got to go. They're at the peak of their value to the market, and I know that their value is about to decline. We say we build businesses. You know, we think about, you know, building businesses. We don't actually build them around the stars. You build them around the B team who know how to collaborate. That's the secret. Not building it around a collection of stars. Very important. There are a few stars who never leave or lose their humility. But most stars, or too many stars, tend to get above even themselves. So it's having the right people, making sure that you're not doing a collection of stars. Then you've got to have great group process. You've got to be able to get people to start learning from each other. You want people to be, you know, approach rather than avoid. What do I mean by that? If you think about, you know, the animal kingdom, most animals are one or the other. Lions are approach animals. Anything that moves might be lunch, right? Any shaking in the bush. So you're going to go investigate right now. Find out. You're going to pick it up. You're going to look at it. You're going to shake it. You may even claw at it because it could be delicious. On the other hand, if you're an impala, anything that moves might be a predator, might be a lion. And you're going to run the other way as quickly as you can. Now, for most of what we do, do you want your people to be, that's interesting. There's something, new technology out there, new innovation, potential disruptor. Well, let's pick it up. Let's shake it. Let's figure it out. Or do you want them to say, not in my job description, not going to happen. And it's all about creating a culture of learning rather than compliance or don't make a mistake. If the culture is don't make a mistake, you will never be successful in the world that we're headed into. The culture needs to be one of, that's interesting. Let's learn about it. I don't know exactly where this is going, but let's try it. It could be delicious. So it's those two things coming together. That's another way of thinking about creating the high-performance team of the future. And a third way to think about it, I always do this graphically as well for those of you who are more visual. Start off at the beginning. You have a problem. You build some trust within the group. You set some goals. You also set some boundaries, time, money, etc. And then you allow people to explore. You then try to reach convergence, and you deliver. That's what in terms of a particular project, that's what it should look like. I always think it looks like a stingray, if that helps you visually. The mistakes that teams make tend to look one of the nature of these. So you start here, and you think, let's not set any boundaries. Let's just let the group, let everybody explore. Here's the risk. You just keep talking. Surely you've been to this meeting. I've been to a few of these meetings where it's all exploration. In the end, you have no idea what's going to happen next. So it's just a complete, usually typically a failure to decide. We call it, well, let's just have a brainstorming session with no boundaries or something along those lines. Like, no, there need to be some outer limits. And this is what a key role that any leader plays, you know, in getting people to collaborate, is setting the boundaries. Or you have the next leader come along and say, yeah, you were all over the place, and I need to make this much more efficient. Let me do this for you. Process, skip it. I have the answer. You're doing that, you're doing that, you're doing that. Done. Surely you've been to that collaboration as well. I certainly have. And what happens is the implementation falls apart, right? Because people don't agree, they don't understand, they don't like it. So that's failure to implement. Two basic failures. Here's a third. And that is failure to really deal with the diversity in the room. If there's anything that's going to describe teams of the future, and if you look backwards, right, and going forward, the big trajectory change is diversity. This is from a study I did a few years ago looking at diversity propensity to trust. Four questions on a survey. It's a part of agreeableness in terms of personality. When you walk into the room, do you believe that most people are trustworthy? Or do you believe most people, you got to be careful? There are a lot of tricky people out there. Diversity on those four questions creates frustration. Why? Because I think most people are trustworthy. I just share. I just put myself out there. You, on the other hand, don't trust anybody. And you're looking at me thinking, what is he doing? Is he that naive? He's just sharing? Is this a trick? Like, what is going on here? And I'm really going to stand back now. I start getting frustrated because I'm putting myself out there and you are sitting back in that seat sharing nothing. And I'm like, come on, what's wrong with you? You know, we're on a team, we're collaborating, like, come on. And so it goes. It undermines trust, ultimately leading to poor team performance. So if we can find difficulty in collaboration on something as simple as that, this is a study looking at MBAs, our MBAs, before they come in, and then it's 8 months later, they're pitching to VCs for money in these teams. Real money, real VCs. If they get money, they're then an entrepreneur after they finish their MBA. A lot at stake here for these teams. And yeah, I can predict their performance, you know, from four questions that I took 8 months earlier. Again, it's a difficult one to deal with. And it turns out, the best performing teams are where everybody is keen to collaborate and trust most people. Although teams work perfectly fine if nobody trusts anybody, right? Because it's trust but verify. Everybody knows what the rules of the game are. Nobody gets frustrated. The problem is actually when you have diversity on it. And then people don't have the same idea about what the rules of the game actually are. So diversity. Now, I'm talking about all different types. It can be gender, nationality, but also functional, length of service, generation, personal values. I mean, there's deep level diversity we don't see, and then there's the stuff we do see. Both matter. Now, teams that embrace diversity of all kinds get an ROI, right? ROI, return on inclusion. How important is inclusion here, and will it get us what we're looking for? So if you look at, I picked one company statement, I could pick most any of them. There's usually, this is the kind of reasons why people talk about diversity. And I want to point out, the first one is about social justice. The second one is, it's good for business. But when you look at collaboration, diversity, and performance, what is the relationship between the two? Not what you want it to be, what is it? We all know what we want it to be. What do you think? Makes things worse? Yeah? No, usually somebody trots out McKinsey 2016 and starts going on about, you know, it's definite, it's an upward slope, etc. No takers on that one today. Okay. All right. So what the data actually show us, it isn't negative, it's flat. One of the most disappointing findings in the social sciences. It satisfies neither the critics nor the supporters of diversity and is incredibly frustrating. This is from a meta-analysis looking over 25 years of diversity research. No serious scholar is going to stand up here and tell you that diversity is a guarantee of a good outcome. Now, there are plenty of people arguing why and when under certain circumstances. That's much closer to the truth. Here's the way most people think about diversity. They would argue that diversity gives you two things simultaneously. It gives you information, right? That's the good stuff. It also gives you social cohesion problems. People are different. We have this coordination challenge. Now I start to want to blame you when something goes wrong, or just, you know, people are different and I find that uncomfortable. And that leads to mixed bag on team performance. But that's not the whole story. The data, if you do a linear relationship, is flat. The shape of the data looks like this. The best teams in the distribution are highly diverse. The worst teams in the distribution are highly diverse. With greater diversity comes greater diversity of outcome. So the whole challenge is not, and if you think about it, you know this. You know, we used to think that, you know, you solve the diversity problem by just hiring more women, right? And that would solve itself. Does anybody still believe that anymore? Right? That's not it, right? It's much more complicated than that. And so you'll want to say, like, how do I get on the upward trajectory rather than the downward one? Because with diversity, which is the reality, anybody who thinks they're not managing diversity, you know, is crazy. Diversity is who we are. Do it well. If you have a question, we need the microphone. One of you, this gentleman back here, has a question.
If you broke the population down in the study to baby boomers, millennials, Generation Y, Do the results come out the same?
So far, in a nutshell, yes. There are some differences that get a bit are very nuanced and complex. The older generations tend to either be a bit more cynical or negative. It's true, compared to the younger generations who kind of grew up thinking that way. But in the end, the millennials, as well as everyone else, get into the actual mix and find it frustrating. Right? Again, it's like you look forward to it, you think it's going to be great, and then the reality is kind of, okay, I'm really being challenged in a way I didn't expect or like or want. So you end up with a similar kind of pattern. Yeah, so here's the issue. I've been interested in diversity in teams for a long time, and I've been a team scholar of conflict for a long time because they're very carefully intertwined. Diversity creates tasks, what I would call task conflict, debate, discussion, etc., right? And that's what it's supposed to do, yes? That's what it does, definitely. And the relationship between performance and debate within a team or discussion, differences of views shared, well, how would you put that relationship? Any thoughts? So upwards, more debate is good. So does it depend on how the members of the team deal with conflict?
Yeah, so some teams, will perform great, assuming that, you know, they are individuals or the members of the team can deal with conflict effectively and use it, you know, in a productive session, in a productive fashion. Others will just kind of feel, that type of conflict doesn't allow them to perform to their best ability or engage with other team members, right?
Yeah, so it depends on a couple of things, one of which obviously is how you handle it, whether you can separate discussion from what's coming next, which is personal conflict or affect, negative affect.
Discussion is not conflict, though, is it?
Depends on what if you think conflict is a negative word, then you'll use other words. It's still a difference of point of view, right? So it depends on how you define conflict. I'm going to call it task conflict. If you don't like conflict, call it discussion or debate.
I like conflict, actually.
Okay. And it also depends a little bit on how complex the problem is. So if you have a really simple problem, then debate actually doesn't tend to help you much. The more complicated the problem, then the relationship starts to look like this. Right? So you need a certain amount of discussion and debate, but you can have too much. You can have too much of a good thing here. So you'll want some, particularly if the problem is complicated. And as I argued, the world is more complicated than ever. It's getting more complicated than ever. This is more and more. It's a rare thing that you would have a serious team look at something that's pretty straightforward. You'd probably just assign it to someone and let them deal with it, right? Far more efficient that way anyway. But task conflict oftentimes leads to relationship conflict, negative affect, I hate you kind of stuff. And you probably won't be surprised, what is the relationship between relationship conflict and performance in a team? How helpful is it for people to hate each other? Right? Not very helpful. So it's as you would expect, the more people dislike each other, the worse the problem, okay, or the worse the performance. Here's the issue. In every real-world team we've ever looked at, and we've looked at thousands of teams, I myself have done everything from boards and top teams to collaboration on the assembly line to MBA teams and everything in between, and very consistently it's about 0.7. So zero is no relationship. One is perfect relationship. They are identical, and they on average they're about 0.7. They're highly correlated. So we try to encourage discussion and debate. If you're not careful, it turns into negative affect. So the big challenge in diversity and the reason that coordination is so important is because you've got to encourage people to share, right? Psychological safety, really important. And then you get to a point where you need to say, hold on, right? If we go too much further here, because you think, well, a certain amount of discussion is good, more is even better, be very careful. You need to kind of back off, especially once you've had a big misunderstanding about perhaps a deadline that affects a deadline on a project. Relationship conflict tends to lead to process conflict. Disagreements about how much time to spend doing what's equitable or fair within the team, how much time do we spend together versus doing stuff individually. Now, if you want to know, of the three, the one that makes people most emotional and irrational, it's the third. People can live with people they don't like in the workplace, generally. What they can't live with is that person gets a much better deal than me. Well, you've now implicated issues of fairness here. Now, when you get to that stage, it really is quite difficult to retrieve. So here's what research says, okay? When trust is high, if you do have a high degree of trust, you can use in most any process. Now, be very careful. I've done these studies repeatedly. If I ask a group of us here, a team, who are collaborating together, what is the level of trust between us? All of these guys here will all pretty much agree with each other, and then I'm the team lead. The correlation between my response and everybody else's? Zero. Why? Because I have a dyadic relationship with each person as a lead, with performance reviews, with hiring, with, you know, opportunity, etc. And every one of them is going to put a nice face on it, or the nicest face they can. And they're all perfectly reasonable people with me, ergo they must trust each other, yes? Now, never mind that this guy over here hates her, and then, you know, in the background, when I'm not looking, takes out the knife and stabs her in the back as hard as he can make it happen. But she's not going to tell me either, because she doesn't want to look like the complainer. So the two of them both smile and nod at me, me being unaware. Now, their colleagues down the hallway know. So be very careful, because trust is not something that's easily measured if you're in a status role within the group. Now, here are some other options. Next option, some kind of consensus, or what I call qualified consensus. Nobody disagrees. Nobody says this is a stupid idea. And I've recently written a big paper about this. There's a big difference between consensus, which is everybody says, you know, it's a good idea, it's the best idea, I'll vote for it, versus flipping it on its head, nobody says this is so stupid we should stop, or so bad we should stop. Plenty of people end up in the middle. And if you have somebody who says genuinely, I think this is a disaster in the making, you probably aren't taking account of all the issues, okay, unless they're trying to play games with you. But for the most part, if somebody's that opposed, you still need to keep talking about it. You need to keep dealing with the issue. I saw a hand up here.
You mentioned that the correlation between the trust that the leader has, will vote for, is completely different from the team itself. Is it always higher, or is just zero correlation?
It's zero correlation, so it can be higher.
It can be lower.
It can be lower sometimes too. Okay. It's just made on a completely different basis than what's going on in the team. The team kind of all see each other, and as team lead, if you have the status position within the team, there's lots of things you won't see, good and bad probably. All right, so get people to say, okay, I can live with it. Next option, leader decide. I've heard all the arguments. As team lead, I'm going to make the call. And then the fourth one has some version of, we talked about it, this is what most of us want to do. Or one that's officially leader decide, what the leader does is doesn't want to take a point of view and says, let's just have a vote and we'll go with what most people want. Or my sense is most of us think this is the right decision. What I can tell you is that anything that looks or smells like voting results in teams that are unhappy and perform poorly. Why? Because voting is typically used to shut people down. My sense is most of us agree. Yeah, because she's been complaining about it for the last hour, right? And she has a point of view, and I'm tired of listening to it, so let's just shut it off. It's a way to shut it down. Now, and so what I would urge, by the way, is that you not go down that road at any shape or point or time. And I have replicated this research over and over, as have other people. If you're making the call as a team lead, you say, my judgment is this is what we should do. Because the problem is, as soon as you start saying, you know, this is what most people think, and I know I'm on the losing end, I now disengage from it. Or if you have no choice because voting is required by, if you're on a board, most boards are required, for example, to have some form of voting. What you do is, as soon as you have the vote, you go talk to the losers, not the winners. Don't go in the winner's circle and feel good. Go to the people who've just lost and make sure you don't lose them emotionally. And that's the mistake that is typically made. I've got a question down here.
How do you manage the highest paid person in the room syndrome?
Good question. I think it's a little bit like the star problem. And I would say that's why you have to work very carefully. It depends on what level of authority you have. If you're the team lead and there's somebody in the room who's the, you know, founder, the star, right? Then, you know, you can start by talking to them. You know, then, depending upon status, right? If you have the status to speak to them, you can speak to them. and try to talk about why there might be some issues there. If you don't, then what you've got to do is your best shot is probably only ever going to be some form of qualified consensus. And you're going to be hard-pressed to achieve it because, you know, people are going to, especially when that person goes on in public record of saying, this is what I want. And what typically happens is then you get offline conversations. And so it's another process that I've been studying a lot of in the last few months. So when you go offline and go outside the structure of the team, it's okay as long as there's a focus on what's really happening here, what's really going on. It can't be venting, like that guy is a complete blah, blah, blah. Because venting actually will undermine quite bad. And it's as tempting as it is, it's very tempting. We all know the problem. But try to stick to how do we understand the problem? Because if the rest of us can, in these offline conversations, can come to a particular point of view about what the issue really is, then you try to apply the power of the group, which is, I know you're the highest paid person in the room, but everybody else around the table thinks something different. And if you can explain that in a rational way, you have a shot at making the influence. Because no matter who you are, being the lone person against everyone else is really difficult, even if you're high status. Now, it's easier if you're high status than low, but I think that's probably your best shot. It's not very nice. It creates extra work for you. But nevertheless, I think that's your best shot at it. Okay, questions?
I think that particular observation and what you mentioned is just so interesting. The question that we have overall is, and that is why shared values and culture is just so important, because then people feel that they can, whatever that culture dictates, people feel that they can question even the opinion of a highest paid person or HIPPO or whatever that is called. And the second thing is, the one thing that when we talk about collaboration, the data point of it, right? How important is the data in questioning something? So it's not just about opinion. What is your opinion driven by? And that would give you a license to question. Have you seen that in your research, that when people question and the opinions are kind of different and conflict occurs, how important is the data piece at the back?
Yeah. So I'll respond to that in a couple of different ways. You're anticipating exactly where I'm going next with what research reminds us about or finds, which is that the most important thing is figuring out the kind of common ground. What do we all know and agree on? What are the facts, the data behind it? And then at what point do we diverge? Is this a values-based divergence, or is there some unknown data or information? Chances are it's probably a values-based difference, or if it is, at least you can then talk about it as such. And so that's exactly what you need to do, is to get to the bottom of it. And you'll want to establish rules of the game up front. I mean, many moons ago, one of my best friends from age kind of 11 onwards in life was a partner at one of the big consultancies. And I remember him telling me when I was, you know, years ago coming into the classroom, talking about, well, the first thing I do every time I start a new engagement is I start with the rules of engagement, okay? And they're behavioral, okay? That I expect this and I expect this stuff. I don't want to, you know, and if there's a problem, here's how we're going to resolve it. And it was a whole, you know, a page long list of things. And at the time, I remember thinking, wow, that seems like overkill compared to most teams I've been on. But the research, you know, ever since, totally vindicates what he was doing. That establishing the ground rules of interaction is critical, particularly the more diverse the team is. Again, this is about how do I create the culture, the platform for this diverse team to flourish more than kind of top-down, I'm going to force cooperation. It's very difficult to really force cooperation. Okay, it's easier to anticipate coordination and to deal with it once it arises. It's also easier to set the groundwork up front with our expectations. Again, we also had this event. We do an annual global survey of boards here and then report on it through the Leadership Institute and have a speaker. And one of the, we had Sir Paul Miners here a few years ago, and he's chaired, I don't know, a dozen boards in the city or more. And he does exactly the same thing. When he appoints a new director, he starts with, here are the behavioral expectations I have for you. And yes, there's a bunch of, you know, either fiduciary or boxes to tick of things you need to do. But for me, the important things are description of how we will interact. because then you've got something to go back to when there is a problem. Right? So that's exactly where we're going here. Clear and transparent rules of engagement to deal with this complexity. Focus on creating the common knowledge. What does the data actually tell us underlying this? Is the problem values-based, or is there something else, other data we're unaware of? Now, I talk about known knowns here. The news made a lot of fun of Donald Rumsfeld a few years back, talking about known knowns, known unknowns, etc. But he actually was actually right. Creating the understanding of who knows what and that we all know it is a critical step when you're working in a diverse environment and needing to collaborate. We curate teams by bringing together teams of experts. So create that shared understanding of the problem before solution. Motivate team members to understand each other. So what are the behavioral expectations? So some form of team agreement where I lay these things out as I begin. It's not the norm of what happens out there right now in most places, but it should be. So what are the goals? What are our behavioral expectations? Attendance, you got it, kind of thing. And you can discuss it. Okay, it's absolutely fine. They will agree all this stuff before things get emotional because it's a pretty rational thing to do. Don't try to insert it after people have become angry because then it looks like you're playing politics here in some way. Politics with a small P here. And third, to create these integrated problems, psychological safety, encourage internal information sharing, particularly if what you're learning about is a disruptive problem. So I have just found out that a new technology may make our business obsolete over the next decade. Okay? It doesn't get any bigger than that. Don't go in alone and talk about it. Truth in a group almost never wins. Let me repeat that. Truth in a group almost never wins. Truth supported wins. So what you need to do is to bring the expert into the room with you. It's worth the effort to do it so that everybody can have the same shock as a collective experience, and they all kind of go back to that moment when we talk about how to address the issue and how we're going to respond to it. So we oftentimes think about the experts are out there. What we need to do is just go and grab everything off the shelf. Better metaphor, let's bring that into the room, especially if it's big, and let's just let everybody talk about it together. It's less efficient in terms of your time in the short run, but in the long run, much more efficient. A couple other things, proactively manage conflict. Don't let it bubble up, especially the relationship conflict, process conflict. That stuff is highly volatile. Don't resort to voting. This is from some work I did a few years ago looking at collaboration and conflict resolution. The best place to be is up here where you get good performance, good satisfaction. Focus on things that are good for the whole team and preemptive. What kind of conflict might we experience? How do I set a team agreement or a team understanding before people get emotional? Want to do that? You can maintain performance if you are reactive, but people will be unhappy about it. You're going to make people happy if you talk about it early and you deal with everybody's individual quirky responses and requests. So we need a team understanding about how we're going to work together. So what would make you happy? And what would make you happy? And what would make you happy? And we'll just add it all together. That makes people happy, but isn't very effective. And for God's sakes, okay, please, don't wait for people to get angry and then satisfy, that particular individual or somebody. So-and-so is always late to the meeting. And I wait till everybody gets angry. And then it's like, okay, so what are we going to do about it? Everybody's in the mode to be punitive to the person who's always late. This is not healthy, especially if that person has something we need from. All right, a couple of other things. If you're doing work, well, we're all doing work virtually these days. It matters whether you meet in person. And the research, again, very clear on this one. Bring people together. If you're doing virtual work, it's worth the cost and investment. When you do, don't overprescribe the time together. Let people just get to know each other. And you think, my God, I've spent so much money bringing people together. I've got so much stuff I want to share with them and make sure everybody knows. Big mistake. You can information share once people feel comfortable. You get people together and you allow them to interact. They feel comfortable. Now when you send out the emails, they feel an obligation to actually read it rather than trying to do it all in person. It sounds easy when I say it. That's almost never what happens, from what I know. Team leaders are obviously need to be self-aware, ask for feedback. Great teams are always full of surprises. Just expect the unexpected. So you just know where it's going to go exactly, but you've got to be up for the adventure and for the journey. And in particular, teams of the future are looking more diverse than ever. So the focus I talked about earlier is on creating a culture of learning rather than compliance. If you remind yourself every day that, you know, learning rather than compliance, that's the single most important thing I can tell you walking away today to keep in mind for teams of the future. So that being said, you know, never doubt that a small group of people, citizens, can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. It's a famous quote by Margaret Mead, who was an anthropologist in the early part of the 20th century, about 100 years ago. And just to make a point, these are teams that each and every one of them, in their own way, you know, changes the world. There are a few fictional ones, but mostly not. And there's quite a range here. If you want the women, the real women in Hidden Figures are the women on the right, okay, who sent the first man into space. The one on the lower left, almost nobody knows. In the 1960s, the plan was to fill San Francisco Bay and put housing on it because there was a housing shortage. So rather than going up into the hills, we'll just cover the bay in housing. Now, you know, that didn't happen. And it only didn't happen because three college wives got together and decided they wanted to fight that plan, even though it had been approved and they were literally filling in the bay every day. A small group of people collaborating and committed changed the world. They change our companies, they change our world on a regular basis. So this is powerful stuff from my point of view. Loads of other things. I have a personal website, which if you want to go to randallspeterson.com, everything I've ever published, everything I've ever done in terms of video work is all on there. And it's all free. Just go and take it. If it can help you, I'll be thrilled. And, you know, if there's anything else you need, or if you ever want to just drop me a line, you're looking for a resource on something to do with collaboration and teamwork, I'll be very happy to respond to that and share what I know. Do you have a question?
So on learning rather than compliance, if you're the back office and compliance is sort of what you mostly do, I mean, how do you sort of encourage and approach that?
Okay, a great question. I don't want to suggest that compliance is a bad thing. There are things we all need to comply with and are necessary. But even in the process of compliance, you know, the idea of learning, so do our specs we ask people to comply with achieve what we want them to achieve? Let's find out. Right? It's actually a good thing. It makes our compliance processes better. So that's why I'm suggesting that, you know, not just compliance, but learning has to be at the core. Yeah?
Thank you.
All right. Question here?
So about diversity, what I see is that companies that do it well, like Google, you're saying, right? They have diverse people, but at the same time, they spend a lot of time interviewing people, selecting the right people. So I suspect there is, they look for diversity at some levels, but a common ground in other levels, right? In the people they hire.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you actually balance that, right? So you want diversity of expertise perhaps, but maybe common values in people who will collaborate more naturally or something like that.
Yeah. Any criteria on which we select, it should always be tied back to what's the core of our business. Mm-hmm. What is it that we actually, where is it that we really make money? If you know that, then you will probably pick relative homogeneity on a core kind of skill set related to that and let everything else go. Sometimes it's historical, okay, and not necessarily tied to how we make money right now. And sometimes it's just tradition. We've, for whatever reason, our founder, you know, was that kind of person, and we still bring people in like that. Is it really still tied to the core of our business? If it is, fine. If it's not, that's fine. And this is what a really good kind of HR process, HR-driven strategy process should really look at. And that's how I would do it. You're absolutely right. They're not just choosing anything at random, right? There are certain things that they need, but then are very careful. How do we maximize diversity on everything else? Okay? And that's really the recipe for success. Okay. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here. I hope you found it interesting. And please do visit the website and stay in touch with me and obviously with the school. Thank you.
This lecture is from LBS Live at London Business School. Find out more about LBS's short programmes at london.edu/executive education. And for more fresh ideas from LBS's experts, visit www.london.edu/LBSR.